that by conventional medicine, then you can make a difference early. So, for instance, if you have breast cancer, if you intervene early, you could live a long life. But if you don't, you could die very young. So there are certain things, there are a lot of different factors. I don't think it's a simple answer. It's just that I have to kind of admit that I just have a long-standing mistrust of the medical system. So that plays into my judgment, because I've seen the misunderstanding and the sort of just the systemic problems that are there. You know, it may be that vegetables won't cure you, but having a healthy diet where you're going through a process can help you. If your system is going through a process where it's being compromised, then you build it up first. You don't break it down with garbage food and then compromise with chemical. You know, so there's a lot of shades to it. I got to go. Could you let in our upcoming host? We are about to go away, and I want you to stay tuned for Hour of the Wolf with Jim Freund. We will be back next week, at least that's the plan. We'll never know how things go. But thank you, and thank you for joining us today, and stay tuned. And I
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. This morning, a very specific topic, a very important issue. I have no idea what it is, but it will emerge. But to help us along our way, our guest is Terrence Taylor. Stay tuned.
Your lips move, but I can't hear what you're saying.
Dar Williams. What a really brilliant cover of that song, Comfortably Numb. There, it's not live yet, so you can move it. We're talking about microphones, people. They thought I was talking about a hamster.
Or a dead body.
Yeah, or a dead body, yes. Yes, the new
It's not live yet. It's okay to touch it.
The zombie, yes. What was I saying? Well, so this is how last week's show went, and I've got to be more focused. Okay, the song Comfortably Numb sort of describes me to a certain extent. Not the drug part of it, but the way that my mind has been going. I felt that there was this vast interregnum of radio. We were Hour of the Wolf was basically off the air for 5 weeks during the last fund drive. Actually, it was on 1 week where Ken Gale was the host. But I was not able to come in. And Ken did yeoman duty in doing a 2 a.m. to 5 a.m. special program. So I was off the air for like a month and a half, which for me is, well, forever. And people who know the history of this program may remember the days when it was not, when not only was it 5 days a week, but I also did a children's show called Kinderfantasiegeschichten, and I did a music show called Music of the Spheres, and I was a regular daytime engineer for programming here. So when we came back, the first thing was, oh, it's Douglas Adams' birthday. And I hadn't played any Hitchhikers in quite a while. And I feel a proprietary interest in that for reasons that I explained 2 weeks ago, because I was the first person on the continent to broadcast Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, which many people still think mistakenly is a book. It's a radio drama. The book is a novelization. Even Douglas called it that. After that came the TV show, then there was a play, then there was a actually rather good Infocom game, except you could never get the Babelfish. It was impossible. There was no. They actually had T-shirts saying, I got the Babelfish. It took something like 17 steps in order, involving a water cooler and, of course, a towel, all kinds of things. So, had to do that 2 weeks ago. No sooner do I finish that show and go home that I find out that Sir Terry Pratchett had died. And I had interviewed Terry twice. One on the day that he got his first. And I always get confused about the royalty, the knighthoods and all that. He got, I think, an OBE, and then he became, but that was not, he was not yet Sir Terry. Maybe it's the other way around. Maybe he was a CBE, a something of the British Empire, a writer of the British Empire. I don't know. But what he got was a ribbon and a medal. Then later he was knighted about 5 years ago. So I get home and I find out that he had died, which we knew was oncoming of early onset Alzheimer's. Not the medical term for it, but that's basically what it was. And Terry and Douglas was 49 when he died. Terry was 66, I believe. This is too young. And especially for two people who are just brought so much joy into the world. By the way, speaking of people who put joy into the world, I saw online today that coming up in England, this is almost worth traveling to England for, the 50th anniversary of concert of the Bonzo Dog Doodah Band playing with the Ruddles, who are basically the same people. Vivian Stanshall, who was really one of the creative geniuses, along with Neil Innes, behind the Bonzos, died young also. But, I mean, the Ruddles and the Bonzos, come on. Brilliant, brilliant, brilliant stuff. So, During the time that I wasn't on the air, I recorded several good interviews, which have yet to broadcast. One of them with Elia Dawn Johnson. I still have an interview to broadcast with Genevieve Valentine that I did actually as far back as October. It was her guest of honor interview at CapClave, where I was honored to interview the guest of honor. But I was going to get a reading with it. And I ran into a room at the con where she was doing a reading. And she looked at me and shook her head. No, she didn't want to be recorded. So, okay. I just said, KGB? She said, yes. Okay, so I knew that I would get the KGB recording from Gordon Linsner, who's been recording them for Ellen and Matt and me. And his machine failed. So we didn't get that. So that's in the can. And Arwen Dayton, Aaron Ellis Dayton, who is starting off a new, let's put it this way, the first book of her YA trilogy is just coming out now, and several months ago she sold the movie rights for gazillions. So that's going to be like, you know, it's not totally dystopian, but it's in that divergent, insurgent, mockingjent kind of world. But it's much better. I actually enjoyed the book a good deal, which I can't say for the others. Although I understand Insurgent got good reviews. Speaking of reviews, Dan Persons has moved out of New York City. However, movies are not only found in New York. They're also occasionally in Philadelphia, despite the fact that it is Philadelphia, where he is now ensconced. And as he settles in, he's going to start doing reviews for the show again. So I have these things in the can and great things coming up, but I thought it was better to talk to our good friend Terrence Taylor and invite him here, and he's going to do something this show has lacked for a while, if I can shut up, a long reading. But first, and by the way, your mic is now on. But first,
yes,
the third Wednesday in April at KGB, James Morrow and Ken Liu. Don't miss it. I'm not going to tell you anything about him. Why should I? Two wonderful, wonderful, wonderful writers. Ken Liu is also doing a great deal of work translating a lot of modern Chinese science fiction into English, some of which we have done on Lightspeed. And Clark's World, where Kate Baker reads his stories. We have to add Lightspeed. We have different actors. Lightspeed this week, by the way, Ursula K. Le Guin. Don't miss it. What's the Atlantis story? 1975. It's one of our rare reprints. Well, rare for the podcast. The New Atlantis. The New Atlantis, written by Gabrielle DeCure. Go to lightspeedmagazine.com. It's free. Then, on April 21st, there is no April 7th New York Review of Science Fiction Readings. We are skipping that one in order to accommodate a teacher. Because his semester will be over by that time. And that teacher is a fellow by the name of Samuel R. Delaney, one of the very first people who I worked with here at WBAI in, get ready, 1967, when he was doing his radio drama of The Star Pit for Baird Searles. And as I like to say, I made that possible. I made that drama possible because who was going to fetch the coffee? Who was going to roll the...
carpet up at the end of the night.
Thank you. That was exactly it.
Yes. A very neat studio.
I wasn't there for the recording, but I was there for the post-production that Ed Woodard was doing.
Samuel R. Delaney, who's this year's Grandmaster of Science Fiction, one of the great writers of SF. I point out that the difference between he and many other writers is in 100 years he will be studied in classes like Octavia Butler and a couple of others. But he is a grandmaster, and he will have just turned 74. He's born April 1st. So, in 1941. With him, a good friend of ours here at Hour of the Wolf, Sam J. Miller, who is nominated for a Nebula Award this year for a story that, yes, we did at Lightspeed Magazine. When I say we, by the way, I am the host of the podcast. I'm not an editor of the magazine. That's John Joseph Adams. I don't produce the podcasts. That's Skyboat Media on the West Coast. But after the actors perform, I get the tapes, I record them, I add the sound effects by Jack Kincaid and the music by Jack Kincaid, and I am your host, which is a lot of fun. It's like a real announcing job. And we won the Hugo Award this year, so we're proud. So let's see, I did KGB, I did the, which is the third Wednesday in April, the following Tuesday at, KGB is at 85 East 4th Street. Admission is free. Buy a drink, please. There's no minimum, but buy a drink.
It never hurts the stories.
It never hurts, yeah. The New York Review of Science Fiction reading on the 21st will be at 388 Atlantic Avenue. There's some radio station there. Look it up. It's very accessible. Even the Long Island Railroad goes there. It's like five blocks from the Barclays Center, but there are even closer subway stops. Okay. I think I have covered my announcements.
All the major bases.
Yeah, I think so. So last week we had to do a memorial for Terry Pratchett and Terrence Taylor. Joined in for the last 20 minutes of that, or 15 minutes of that.
Electronically, since I was on deadline, sadly.
Yes.
So here I am now live to make up for being a ghostly voice last week.
Yes.
I'm in present. I've been taking a hiatus from writing for a while because I've been editing a feature-length documentary for a friend of mine called An Unknown Country, which was basically telling the story of Ecuadorian Jews who had gotten there during World War II because they were running from the Nazis, as so many people were. And
my mother's family went to Morocco.
Those were two centers. The Philippines, there were several basic places. There was a documentary made in our second year of editing. There was a documentary about the exodus to the Philippines, which was a much simpler story. Essentially, the president of the Philippines said, sure, and signed a document, and they came. I mean, it wasn't as complex as the Ecuadorian immigration.
Although the Moroccan was, it was just known.
I would think it would have to be fairly complex since the Germans were already marching through Africa, northern Africa in particular. So I'm sure Morocco was an interesting experience.
But that's for some other time. Trek and my father's. There's a movie there.
Oh, there's many movies and many of these stories. The thing is that there are so many stories, and it's interesting. But it sucked up any narrative skills I had for 2 years, and I basically so I'm just coming back to writing narrative again.
Which and we're waiting for the third book of your...
Well, this is actually, I was going to say, this is actually in lines with what I'm doing tonight, because, two things have happened. One, I wrote the story I'm going to read was I think there should be another collection. It was submitted to the Hidden History Anthology.
Mm-hmm.
I was invited along with a host of other writers that I know to submit things. I came up with an idea for a story I liked. It was essentially a prequel.
The Long Hidden.
Long Hidden, Long Hidden. That was the... I knew, not Hidden History.
Edited
Long
by
Hidden.
Daniel Older and Rose Fox. And published by Cross Genres Press.
There we go. And I had submitted this story. It was narrowly missed acceptance. They basically, you know, told me it was like, it was so hard. It was just a little something at the ending, and we all just couldn't, but yeah, we really struggled with it. And it was sort of like, it's like being, you know, asked out on a date, and you get halfway through sex, and they say, I really need someone else to finish this for me, because you're so good, but you're not quite good enough. I have to leave now and go get Bob or whatever. But so it was a sort of like, thank you. I'm glad it was a difficult decision. I kind of wish you'd mentioned that. I kind of changed the ending. I actually have an ending change. So it didn't quite squeak that far, where if you could just fix this problem,
we'd accept it. Are those days over when editors really worked with writers?
Well, I think it's like insurance companies and car accidents. Past a certain percentage of damage, it's not fixable. We're trashing the car. So with stories, you know, it's like, you know, if it was 85% there, we could have taken you the extra 15%. But at 75, it's back in your lap. Do what you can. And I actually have a fix. As we were discussing earlier, Gordon Van Geller's wonderful rejections, which are just... He could make a fortune just giving these as editorial notes to people, because I've rewritten two stories.
We should do dramatic readings.
I think we could.
By the writers.
I would actually love to do an anthology of stories that were rejected by Gordon but were rewritten because of his notes that were then published.
Not by him.
Right. So there would be the rejected accepted.
He would love that.
He would. And essentially, two of the stories that I submitted to him, he turned down, but he gave me like a two-line concise explanation of why that was like, ah. And I later went back and rewrote them, and both were accepted in the Dark Dreams anthology.
He is amazing. He writes the best rejection letters in the business.
What Gordon is a wonderfully keen and insightful editor who also loves writing. And if I said to him once at KGB, I said, if you ever teach a class in anything to do with writing, I want to be there.
You sound Clarion.
I haven't made Clarion. I haven't done Clarion. Justin's going to Clarion, though. He got accepted. Yes, we're all very proud. Yes, Justin Keyes, one of the writers in Tabula Rasa.
Yeah.
But yes, so we're all very thrilled for him. But I'm past my Clarion days.
Is he going this year?
I believe it's whatever the upcoming year is. So it would be this year. Yes. He got accepted. Pardon me. Oh, my God. I just compounded something by saying something I shouldn't have said and then cursing when I realized I'd said it. So forget everything I just said, and we won't discuss it ever again. I think they've made their announcements by now. But at any rate, that's what happens when you talk to me at nearly 2 o'clock in the morning. But at any rate, to get back to the main point and get as far away so people forget everything else I've just said, this story I'm going to read is a prequel story to my two novels because... one of the characters dies in the first novel. And I was always regretting that, but I realized he was over 1,000 years old and he'd done a few things. So this is a story about Ramon, my Moorish vampire,
okay.
Set in the 1700s in the early days of the Americas.
Margot liked him. Margot Adler was a good fan of yours.
Oh, yeah. Liked Ramon. Oh, I love
that. She particularly liked... the second book a little bit more than the first because it was more exposition.
And it was, as did I, because
I have a squeamish stomach.
It was far less bloody. It was more character driven. It was the second movement of a symphony. I've always viewed the three novels as a symphonic structure, not unlike Napoleon's symphony. The first novel, overture, first movement, very active, big. Explosive, lays out everything that's about to come. Second, much more contemplative, laid back. We go back, we revisit characters that we know from the first book. It's 20 years later.
The names of these books so people can get them.
Bite Marks. And Blood Pressure, the first two of the Vampire Testaments, and still available on Amazon and in popular bookstores nearby. The third novel has been delayed, partly by 2 years of editing the film, but also 2 years of getting nervous about actually doing it. And I'm
writing that Christmas novel. Writing
the Christmas novel, which was unpublishable, but was a great therapy and did a great deal of benefit to me. I learned a lot writing that book. I still haven't had the courage to read the editor's notes that the agent was kind enough to give me, but I have to read them now because I've trashed the book so much in my own mind, I don't think anything she said could be as bad. I have been getting pressure to finish the trilogy, and I
would hope.
I have to for a variety of reasons, and
for one thing, 2/3 of a trilogy are not.
It's not a trilogy at all. It's and I don't want it to be an unfinished symphony. The other thing is that it's I've set myself a rather hard task in that the third book is the third movement of the symphony, and it has to be the biggest and the best, and everything just has to come to a crashing climax brilliantly. And I've got all the pieces, I've got all the notes, but I'm still arranging them, and I'm still orchestrating. So what has actually brought me back to it, other than the pressure of friends who are like, so what happened, is that we were almost going to interview Anne Rice.
Yes, what happened with
that? We had to follow that up. Because she was going, we were going, we kindly put off the interview in New York.
I was there at Random Penguin about a month ago.
I should have reminded you, but we need to call them up.
I reminded them, actually.
Yes. But what happened was we were kind enough to forego our interview in New York because she was exhausted from the tour, and I don't know how she was doing it. She's in wonderful shape for her. She's just wonderful. But bottom line is that I did arrange to go into the office, meet her, take a picture, get her to sign my copy of Interview with the Vampire, which I just treasure now. So that was a lovely thing. But we got a chance to chat while things were going on. And a absolutely wonderful person, above and beyond anything else, just a genuinely gracious, giving, lovely woman. And we got into a conversation about writing, and she was talking about how she actually came to write the new Lestat book, the Prince Lestat book. And it was essentially, to prepare for it, she went back and reread the earlier books. She read about 5 or 6 of them. She picked the key novels and reread them. And rereading them reintroduced her to the characters, put her back into the voice of the world, made it fresh in her mind. And as she was saying this, I was like, oh my God, that's what I've been avoiding. But that's exactly what I have to do. I can never finish the trilogy until I've reread the first two books. I need to reread them, and I'll know. I know where it is, I know when it is, I know who it's about. And if I read the first two, it'll put me back in there enough. So I have to thank Anne Rice. She opened the door for me to being able to get back in. There's another novel that's been competing for my attention, but it's an avoidance novel. It's a novel I want to write, but it's a way of getting out off the hook for the third vampire novel.
And
I've got to finish
it.
I've got to finish it.
I mean, Bite Marks came out, Blood Pressure came out how long?
2010. The second book came out in 2010. It's been...
It's 5 years.
Yeah, I've got to, like, you know... I pity the people who've been reading
vampires
these books.
Vampires may be immortal.
But not readers.
Right.
And I need to finish this. And I need to close that door. My characters have started to bubble up in the back of my head and ask what the heck I'm doing, because they would like to know where they went. And it takes place... The difficulty is that it takes place 20 years in the future. The first two books were divided by 20 years each. The first book took place in 1986, 87... the second book in 2007, 2008, and the third one has to be 20 years in the future, which is how I've set it up. And it makes perfect sense, but it brings in a lot of interesting elements. So it makes it a nice challenge, which I actually like. So this story is, I guess, what you could call the long hidden, because it didn't make it into long hidden. But it's the hidden long hidden. There we go. I mean, we need a second anthology of the stories that almost made it but didn't quite. We have several people I know we could pull into that. And essentially what it was Roman's arrival in New York. Roman was a vampire of Moorish origin who was turned into a vampire by a Berber witch in the hills of northern Africa very early on at the birth of alchemy. And he basically went on a long tour of the known world looking for a cure for many hundreds of years of his early existence. So in looking for something to write for Long Hidden, I was doing research. And one of the things that's fascinated me ever since the New York Historic Society's show on slavery in New York was slavery in New York. That entire period, how there were free blacks and enslaved blacks and enslaved whites, the whole social structure of that time period, how it functioned both as business and as society. So I had gone through some of that material from their records. I did some more research. There had been a failed slave revolt in the 1700s in New York.
Famous one.
Bloody. Very bloody. And the aftermath was even bloodier. The actual event itself was relatively...
A lot of it took place where we used to be.
When we were
at 120 Wall Street, yes, there was that wall. And a lot of it occurred on that wall.
Yep. It was the farming little strip and things.
Yes, exactly. Yes.
But it was also a harbor. There was trade came in and out.
Absolutely.
And a town. It was interesting.
Right at the entrance,
culture,
but, was 120 Wall.
But right there.
People were hung, drawn, and quartered.
Oh, yes. Well, the slave revolt, I don't want to say too much because it's part of the nature of the story. But at the same time, it fascinated me for various reasons that hopefully will become apparent as I read the story. So the story is called Burial, which will also become explained as the story progresses. The ending is going to change, so you have a rare opportunity to hear a story that is 95% complete, but going to have the last two pages change. But there wasn't time to think it out properly before the reading, so I will actually read it as written. But it is a prequel story, one, I think, perhaps of many to my vampire novels, because I had characters who are quite long lives, and they had done quite a great deal before the first novel, so I find myself interested in exploring some of that. Even as I have another novel I'd love to do about Zora Neale Hurston and Hollywood in the 40s, that would be a follow-up, actually, to the second novel, Blood Pressure, in which she appears as a character during the Harlem Renaissance, and takes on a lover who becomes a vampire, a black vampire, and I wanted to have them reunite like 15 years later in 1940s Hollywood, the early days of World War II, and just before America's introduction into the war, a lot of conflicting feelings. But that's a book for another day.
And if the story is going to take up to
I should start 50 minutes,
we're quickly, already over.
Because we have to go. So I will read quickly and briskly. The New York colony was in chaos as the work sailed into the harbor. Night air filled with the fresh stench of fire and blood. Cries of alarm and screams of fear. Flames, smoke, and the sound of musket and pistol fire drove panicked masses in all directions with no seeming common purpose other than soul survival. The exceptions were women of all colors who herded their children or charges away from the fray toward safer quarters, and slaves who followed the commands of owners to secure their households as they were abandoned. All others acted as if awakened by Gabriel's vaunted trumpet to herald the end of the world as they raced to Judgment Day. Fools all, thought the vampire Ramon as he watched. Damned inconvenient this, said Finn, his ship's captain, who stood beside him on deck. The former buccaneer's ship, newly renamed, belonged to Ramon al-Hazrad ibn Aziz now. Taking over Finn and his crew when they raided the ship he had booked passage on to New York was an unexpected bonus of his journey, and had provided him with a fully staffed vessel of his own. A single bite had completely enthralled the pirate captain and made him subject to Ramon's will, which allowed him to get here directly from Mexico with a minimum of interference. One by one, he had bidden and entranced Finn's crew on the way, all most deserving of his attentions as he made better men of them all under his command. The Irishman scowled. I smell slave rebellion. Heard tell something was afoot with the darkies, but didn't expect so much so soon. His dark master glanced at him, and the man winced, visibly affected by more than regret. Sorry, sir. The slaves, I mean, he corrected. Ramon held his subjects on a tight rein, his control absolute. It took only a thought to chastise the man with brief but emphatic pain. Socially, Finn was still the product of his lower-class upbringing, but useful enough to rebuke the occasional semantic slip with only a slap of Ramon's psychic leash. He would make a gentleman of Finn yet. No one expects an insurrection, Ramon said. He'd seen enough revolutions in his many nights, even helped organize a few in his 1,000 years on Earth. They are dreaded precisely because they are never what you think, nor when. I told ye we'd be better to dock farther out on Long Island, grumbled Finn. Miles and miles of unseen shores. With your smuggler friends? Those days are behind you, Finn. You're my man now, not theirs. If we enter the colony legitimately, we can travel freely. There is a record, a purpose, and a claim. Papers have their reasons. I do not intend to enthrall or murder every suspicious ship's captain who stops us for an impromptu inspection as we make our way to my destination. Even my taste for blood has a limit. Just saying is all, muttered Finn, and nothing more. He knew his Moorish master's moods well enough not to question him on his motives or moves. Orders for the model, sir? Find out what has happened. By morning they should know. Then check on our supplies for the journey north. Ramon sighed as he headed below decks to his windowless chamber, safe from sunlight. He had hoped to make a discreet entrance to the British colony. The night's events had made his arrival virtually unnoticed. Finn's inquiries would tell him if that would soon turn to scrutiny. If so, his local supplier could be called upon to lessen focus on him until his departure. The vampire Tillinghast had been a prosperous merchant in his old life and continued to trade in his new one, even more successfully. Vampires didn't need to be rich. When you could take anything by command, money was meaningless. He was wealthy by choice. It was one thing to get anything you wanted, quite another to be able to provide anything. That was Tillinghast's life, gift in life for almost 400 years ago, and pride in it had forced him to exercise those skills in his considerable afterlife. He always made sure his customers left satisfied, and Ramon had no doubt he could do the same for him, no matter the cause of the conflagration that had greeted him. Or so he hoped. The night brought bad news. Finn had apprised Ramon that there would be nearly a week's delay in their departure, as the ordered supplies had not yet arrived. The martial law, imposed after the night's slave uprising, wasn't responsible, but wouldn't help. It was Thursday. The equipment and provisions for his expedition north would not be there until Monday, at best. He was trapped in New York for nearly a week with nothing to do but wait on his ship. The rainforest sang to him from afar as the gritty air and gray walls of the dark town before him closed in. The untamed wilds of Mexico held more appeal than the soiled cities he had visited of the European colonies. He did not wish to remain in New York any longer than was necessary. It was a dreary, dirty place after almost half a century spent deep in the lush jungles of South America, roaming unexplored tracks in a search to renew his own mortality. That quest had regrettably led him here, but hopefully not for long. Ramon scowled, and Finn shuddered. I wish to speak with Tillinghast.
Said you might. The door is open, my lord, or full, says he.
Finn immediately led him from the ship to a supplier's nearby home, a grand house with a view of the harbor from which he conducted business. Ansley Tillinghast had amassed a fortune in order to conduct trade, all of it traceable to his business, not all legitimate. He prided himself on being able to live comfortably among men, and by controlling cash and merchandise, resources humans respected, he had become respected in a community enriched by his efforts. His home was that of a wealthy merchant, as it was in every era, styles changing, but curtains always thick against the sun and sewn of the same rich fabrics as the furniture upholstery. His china and silverware was all made in New York, as were the rest of his sumptuous furnishings. Tillinghast was wise enough to frequent the best local craft and tradesmen, and to make sure to pay them generously instead of convincing them by vampiric means that they'd been paid. He was a source of shared wealth to those smart enough to fill his needs to acquire it, and wise enough to ask no questions about its source. Once Tillinghast had done his business with Ramon, and satisfactorily explained why his order had not yet arrived, he invited him to stay for a social visit, eager to distract him from any further discussion of the delay or possible financial penalties.
I know this wait is unfortunate for you, but I must admit I am happy to take advantage of it, to enjoy some honest and open conversation with one of my own kind, a rare treat here. We reside few and far between by necessity, or could wipe out entire colonies like that of Roanoke, muttered his host. A most unfortunate affair that nearly exposed us all, at a time when Europe was just becoming modern enough to disbelieve in such as we.
Tillinghast rang a bell, and a young black male servant brought in a tray with glasses and what smelled to Ramon's heightened vampire senses like several bottles of exquisitely aged liquor. He relaxed. There would be some benefit to his visit, at least. Their kind could not eat food, but could enjoy the scent and flavor of distilled spirits, more than humans, though they had no intoxicating effect. His host had an obvious appreciation and the means to indulge it. He would provide well.
After discussing current affairs in South America and news from Europe, they moved on to the particulars of the previous night's disruption. The town was in a blind panic, and the military governor had declared martial law to restore order. It was indeed a slave rebellion, as Finn had predicted, and highly organized. Around midnight, the conspiring slaves had gathered up carefully hidden weapons, firearms, hatchets, swords, and knives, and then set fire to a shed in town. That it was an outhouse might be amusing one day, but no one laughs now, said Tillinghast, as he downed the last of his glass and held it out for a refill. The flames spread to surrounding buildings, and in the rush of whites they came to put them out. The conspirators killed 9 men and wounded 6 or 7. The alarm brought forth enough opposition for them to abandon their efforts and flee into the woods. The militia was called in. They spent the day rounding them up, except the 6 that killed themselves to avoid capture. 20 to 30 in all, names still being taken down from prisoners. Amazing what people will tell you after the loss of a finger or two. The overall death toll is a pittance to such as us, but in a population of just over 5,000, enough to terrify New York. Ramon sighed. Events had been inevitable. When they took over the colony, the British had turned New York into a city of slavers. At least the Dutch had imported slaves to work their farms, a means to an end. The British had seen a more direct profit in slavery than agriculture and improved the commission of that trade considerably, importing fresh slaves from Africa as well as nearer, more settled stock from the Caribbean. Of course, an increased slave population had led to increased risks no number of restrictive laws could eliminate, as events had proved. Besides their victims, the rebels had only harmed themselves. No. New laws were passed and more rigidly enforced, taking even more rights away from the enslaved. A white girl in modest servant garb entered at a momentary break in the conversation, as if on cue, sat at a small spinet and played haunting melodies Tillinghast soon claimed as of his own composition. Ramon accepted another glass. The young man who served them drinks rolled up a sleeve and bared his outstretched forearm, healed marks of previous bleeding still visible on his dark skin. Vampires did not require blood to survive. They fed on life energy. Ramon only drained enough from his crew to survive, too little to slow their duties aboard the work. A vampire's bite infected its victims with a biological agent Ramon had yet to isolate in studies of his own condition. It allowed the vampire to fill its victims' minds with any vision that enabled easy feeding and bound the prey to its predator. Any blood drunk in the process had the same effect on vampires as alcohol or opiates on humans, with the same risk of addiction. It gave their skin a flush of color and brought warmth to the body, a sensation with occasional appeal when he missed his humanity. Ramon declined the boy's proffered arm, so he went to Tillinghast's side. The large man licked his lips and inhaled as deeply as a gourmand with a great delicacy placed before him, then pressed the boy's wrist to his lips, eyes closed, as he suckled lightly. Ramon continued. I understand that service provides much-needed labor and profit for New York, but I have always thought slavery a pointless and barbaric practice. No offense to your house. How else are its subjects expected to respond but with rebellion, particularly if maltreated? My people once enslaved prisoners from defeated nations, an effective way to rebuild with the same hands that did the damage. But even then, I kept none of my own. No matter how well you treat a man trapped into service, he cannot be trusted to accept it fully. You can buy a body, but not a mind. That is ironic, said Tillinghast with a chuckle as he patted red lips with a linen napkin provided by the youth. Never kept slaves, eh? You certainly have a ship full now. My crew? They're enthralled, not... They aren't... Ramon began and then stopped, frustrated, as he realized the bastard was right. What else were Finn and his crew but his slaves, taken by force, even if only mental? How had he never seen his relationship with them that literally? Tillinghast seemed amused by his perplexity. You don't think of it as slavery, because we cannot help our mastery of mortals. Because mental bondage is in the essential nature of our control, not a commercial transaction we choose. Yet anyone on whom you feed belongs to you as surely as any bought here at market. If you're at all unsure, ask your man Finn how he feels about you. He chuckled. You know what his enthrallment would compel him to say, said Ramon. He had heard enough professions of endless adoration from victims over the centuries, glowered over his glass while Tillinghast shook with mirth. His life is better than it was without me, pursued by the law, and subject to slaughter at the hands of nefarious Confederates. Still, Ramon remembered their earlier exchange on the deck of his ship on arrival and his discipline. A ship that had once belonged to Finn until a bite in the throat, a merging of minds, as Ramon fed on him, made it otherwise. He is not his own man, conceded Ramon, though he has no will to resist. I imagine he must remember that he once did. Fair master of foul, there is no doubt what you are, my friend, said Tillinghast. The only difference is we enslave body and soul with no risk of rebellion, an enviable advantage. I could maximize my income if I engaged in the slave trade directly, rather than only providing the means. Sadly, I lack that degree of ambition and enjoy too sedentary a lifestyle. Ah, and I feared it was the moral issue that stood in your way, Ramon said coldly. Tillinghast took no offense, only laughed. You still see the world by mortal standards. I view all my slaves as what they are, whether bought at market or free men enthralled by my bite. One develops the occasional affection, but they are cattle, work animals or food, pets at best. You expressed surprise at my visibility on first meeting me, but I simply command the colonists not to know the truth. Any who can't be deceived by suggestion, I enthrall with a single bite, and their will is mine. I live as a respected member of the community in clear sight. No one questions me, and any who do, die. I see. Ramon suppressed a smile. It sounds so simple when you say it so. Both laughed, and Tillinghast poured more drink. Really, sir, you forget the straight line and all your decades of meandering through the jungle. We are vampires, after all, with the power to sway the minds. Whoops. Ah. The cursor reading on electronic devices.
We will take that break in continuity to mention that this is WBAI, New York.
Both laughed, and Tillinghast poured more drink. Really, sir, you forget the straight line and all your decades of meandering through the jungle. We are vampires, after all, with the power to sway the minds of ordinary men. It has given you a ship and crew at no cost, and the power to pursue your pleasures. Stop playing the human and expand your possibilities. I do not play, Tillinghast. My pursuits are scientific in nature, and as such justify sobriety. A cure, you mean, sought from lost wizards of old Mexico? What do you call them? The autochthonies? A name given them by a scholar who found evidence of them in caves up north. It means original inhabitants. He thought them indigenous to the area, but in my Mexico research I discovered their origin in the ancient Olmecs. So your search continues here. You amaze me, sir. Not many would spend their eternity looking for the exit. He laughed loudly and his great belly shook. Tillinghast was the roundest vampire Ramon had ever met, a man of obvious appetites in the last life as in this one. He also fancied himself a wag, as did too many mortals here. Manhattan Island seemed filled with like minds that fed each other's egos with the products of their own, all as all assured each other of their great wit. Another reason to leave here as quickly as possible. What you see as a blessing I have always viewed as a curse, as did the Berber witch who cast it on me, said Ramon. Were it a gift, I think she would still be here to enjoy its benefits as well. Perhaps she felt you'd make better use of it. A gun can make you a killer or a savior. It depends which direction you fire it. Or whether you choose to do so. My gift, as you call it these days, is solely employed in seeking a way to return it. Tillinghast laughed loudly. Then you are a bigger, more deluded fool than any in this colony, myself among them. He raised a hand to signal a servant. The night grows short. Your supplies will be here by beginning of next week, and you shall be free to continue your quest. Best of luck to you in your endeavors, and if you find your cure, I ask only that you keep it far from me. Tillinghast seemed to find that enormously amusing, too, as he walked him to the door, followed by the boy bearing Ramon's cloak. In the meantime, take advantage of all what remains of our fair town has to offer. If you have a need to feed beyond your crew, send your man to fetch you a sample of my stock like Little John here. I would prefer to keep any activities that would betray the existence of our kind quiet here in my own hometown. Back aboard the work, the evening's conversation lingered in Ramon's head as he retired for the day. He had never thought of himself as a slaver in all the centuries he had controlled humans to feed on them. Rather, he had viewed the control he exerted over those he fed on as parasitic or supernatural, a part of his curse. His subjects were enthralled, not enslaved, though certainly forced to his will by his power, as surely as a slave was possessed by the power of gold. So what right did he have to judge the slaveholders of New York? He sat up restless, confined by daylight. No, their situations were nothing alike. He was different from them. No more slaver by choice than a spider was a blood-sucking predator by anything other than its essential nature. Those in his charge could no more rebel than resist. By feeding on them, they became a literal extension of his will, part of him. Slaves were only property, bought and sold, not joined with their master's minds, but owned by them. Perhaps Tillinghast was right. He needed to stop judging his actions by human standards. No slaver, but something far more fearful, even they should beware. Ramon lay back on his bunk with eyes closed, oddly angry, though not sure with what. He reviewed what he had heard. The rebellion had been an audacious plan, well thought out, if only dependent on inflaming the passions of the rebels' fellows in the heat of the moment. That was what puzzled and irritated him. Ramon had been both a soldier and a man of science in his mortal life, and as such was plagued by a dual demand for things to make sense. 20 to 30 poorly armed men could not possibly have hoped to take control of a colony of the size without help, and must have known that insufficient numbers of sympathizers would rise up to join them to turn the tide. So why make the attempt at all, unless suicidal? Granted, six had indeed killed themselves when faced with capture and certain torture, but that was only cowardice or common sense. The British were nothing if not vindictive. He'd learned that as he'd watched them grow over the centuries from savage peasants soiling themselves in the streets to more civilized savagery on a global scale. No, there had to be a larger vision behind the action, a goal beyond mere momentary insurrection. He had a week in New York with nothing to do. Perhaps he would pay a visit to the imprisoned leader of the rebellion and obtain the answers to his questions, one way or another. Perhaps even free him to continue his efforts, if Ramon deemed them worthwhile. The thought made him smile, a rarity. Ramon considered carefully. He had no loyalties here. Knew from experience the whites would hate him because he was black, the slaves because he was free, free blacks because he seemed freer. None of them understood their animosity as instinctual, that they sensed in him a natural predator. He had seen it time and again, and usually gave none of them any more thought than they gave the concerns of the animals they fed upon. He saw no reason to change his mind here. What was the benefit of his unwanted immortality if not to provide him infinite time for the examination of conundrums like this until he ended it? The machinations of the minds of men were a never-ending story worthy of infinite study. He decided that whatever he did here held little consequence to him, so he could do as he pleased. He resolved to pay a visit come sunset to where the prisoners were kept. With an intellectual puzzle ahead to occupy his restless mind for the next few days he was here, Ramon slept deeply. I will give you all the time in the world. The words ran through his head as he rose from a deep dream of his past. There had indeed been a time when he had embraced the full strength of his nature and unleashed the full power he knew lay within. Terrifying but majestic in that first century of his new life as a vampire, risen from the dead to be Dahiya Al-Kaina's avenging angel. The leader of a 5-year resistance of mountain tribes against the Moorish Empire, she had sacrificed herself to transform him after a battalion of the Empire's army had wiped out a small village, unaware that they violated a truce she had sent her sons to accept. Her band had captured Ramon. A general spreading the word of Allah by sword wiped out his command and held him captive until the fateful day she took him to the desert to perform 3 days of rituals. They had talked often in the week she held him hostage about military right and wrong, about his pursuit of his beloved new science of alchemy. He had foolishly hoped that by sharing himself, forming a bond, she might relent, and they had shared one, it is true. A dedication to duty, he to his empire, she to the scattered mountain tribes she had united against it. Both were warriors caught up in circumstances beyond their control, and each respected that in the other, if nothing else. Before the end, in their last conversation after her ritual was complete, she had confessed to her that all he begrudged his military life was the time it took away from his scientific studies. She had smiled at that as she fed him the slow-cooked brew of vegetables and herbs prepared while she had chanted for 3 days and nights. I can give you time for your studies, she said to him as he gulped down the nourishing potion gratefully, starved enough to accept it. I will give you all the time in the world. They were her last words to him. At the time, he thought she meant to free him, and she did. Threw him a knife to cut his bonds before she flung herself silently into the well. It was only later when the blood fever took him that he understood that she'd sacrificed her life to fuel a curse on his empire, sent him home as an immortal monster with a familiar face that could work its way to the heart of its nation and destroy its leaders. She had almost succeeded. He had traveled by night, wiped out platoons, weakened his nation's great army, and slain any that discovered his secret. He had been nearly unstoppable, a fierce, undetectable assassin for a dead woman's vengeance. The thing that had been Ramon was inhuman under her control, a killer without compassion. In the end, her plan failed. The Empire had bound him with the same ancient magic that created him. Imprisoned for 100 years, he had finally freed his mind from her necromantic control, and then his body from captivity to pursue his lost humanity. He had vowed never to release the monster he became at his rebirth again. But how much had he lost of his potential power in casting those years aside? What had he failed to learn from them about his true nature? It was in that frame of mind that he made his way after dark to the local goal. There were sufficient guards to keep out any human intruders, but not a being that could prevent them from seeing him as he passed, open doors and unlock gates with stolen keys. He had penetrated to the heart of their establishment with no effort. Ramon gazed at the door of the cell that held the leader of the insurrection. The guard outside stood at glazed attention, his eyes unseeing, immobile by mere suggestion. If Ramon bit him even once, the man would swear lifelong fealty and walk his prisoner to freedom himself. It gave him pause for a moment, the ease of movement, the magnitude of the power he held. Buried in the jungle, he had reverted to scientist, worked with cooperative like minds he didn't need to control that shared his enthusiasm for his subject for so long he had almost forgotten how potent a magic it was. Ramon swung the door of the leader's cell open wide, perhaps with a bit too much drama, but felt the moment deserved it after all. He slipped inside and gestured to the doorway. I'm here to free you, he said in stentorian tones. The shadowy figure inside was small. Ramon had expected someone larger, more commanding, not a slip of a youth in his late 20s, beaten and bruised. You assume I am here to be freed, replied the slender black man curled on the floor before him, wrists and ankles manacled but not to the wall. Is it your bonds? I will break them. I think not. He did not move. Ramon stepped back into the doorway, hesitant, when it was clear the man had no intention of walking through it to liberty. The guard still stood dazed outside. He was sure of that much, at least. Am I to be shot in the back while attempting escape? The man asked. Has the governor decided to spare himself the expense of a public trial? Ah, suspicion. Of course, how human. Ramon smiled. That made sense to him. You misunderstand, sir, and may leave safely. There is no threat from which I cannot protect you. For how long? Pardon? Assuming you truly mean me no harm, I assure you others do, and will not take my exit lightly. Eager to make an example of me, they will no doubt rally their best to recapture me quickly. Will you rescue me again, then? Ramon found himself at a loss for words. He had not expected this to be difficult. As an experienced military tactician, he had foreseen any outcome of his offer, but refusal. That is irrelevant. Will you come with me, sir? No. I do not know how you come to be here, or how or why you make this offer, but no. My fate is here with my fellows. Or would you free us all? Damn you, sir. I myself am the hand of fate. Can you not see that? I have questions I would ask in more comfortable quarters, and while you speak eloquently, you make no sense. Ah, eloquently for a slave? Perhaps I only parrot the words I've learned, hence make no sense. I have often met literate men in servitude. No doubt counted many among your friends. The slave smiled, slyly derisive. Ramon glared and bristled indignant. I am no hypocrite and meant no offense to you. I jest, sir. My nature does deserve some explanation. I lived in service to an elderly couple of a decidedly liberal disposition that acquired me at age 8 and saw my education as befitting them as they grew ever older. My mother was free but poor, unable to support all her children, my father dead, and she signed me into servitude with them to be liberated at the age of 21, or upon their passing, with that education as reward. Yet you led a rebellion against them? not them, but he who failed to live up to the terms of my service after their untimely deaths by accident 7 years ago when I was but 18, if accident it was. Their son and primary beneficiary decided when I reached my maturity not to honor the terms of the agreement made with my parent by his, but to keep me enslaved. On what grounds? Grounds, sir? Simply that he chose not to do so. Had he not added grave physical abuse to that insult, I might have borne up long enough to continue to seek legal redress, but he sought to whip my opposition out of me. He raised the back of his soiled white shirt to exhibit ample proof in years-old scars. The others share my marks and story in one form or another. Death was preferable to life as we lived it for us all. Ramon stood silently, no longer proud of his magnificent entrance. This was no simple situation to be made right with a rash act. He felt foolish for taking this on as an amusing distraction. This was a real life, one taken from this man and soon to be ended entirely. So, I see why you are here, but why will you not leave? Because leaving does not take me where I need to go. Ramon noted the hour. He had scant time left to do naught else but this if he did not depart soon. I see you need time to consider, but will visit you 3 times only. Consider each refusal widely. Consider that I may not live to hear them all. I have highly motivated captors. Then accompany me now. We come full circles, sir. The man shrugged. His chains clanked. I have no doubt I will see you tomorrow night at least. The wheels of justice will not turn so quickly that they deprive the good people of New York of a proper show. Twice more, Ramon said, as he faded into the night, locked the doors behind him and woke the guards, left them with no memory of his passing. On his second visit, Ramon smelled the man's blood before he saw it. His injuries of the night before were mild by comparison, face and body now broken, skin smashed aside to reveal muscle and bone, as if an overly enthusiastic sculptor's chisel had mistaken his flesh for marble. I fear I underestimated the direction they would take in entertaining the public, said the man slowly through ruined lips. Interrogation, it seems, is more a battle of flesh than wills. And this? Ramon kicked at a bowl of foul gruel on the floor beside him. Intended as nutrition, must keep my strength up for my execution, after all. I have dealt better with my enemies. Hated them less, perhaps. Your fellows have fared worse. Some have been burnt or hanged. I hear one was broken on the wheel, one hung alive in chains to die of exposure. Good men all, murmured the slumped man on the floor, his face down. Blood dripped from his lips to his crushed hands. Yet you would remain, Ramon paced. I own nothing, sir, not even the clothes I wear. I have had no chance to find love or make a family, and must apply for permission even to see the one I have. My education is wasted in my current circumstance, my future no brighter. Even if I fled, any man with stripes on his back is suspect of escape from slavery. Without written proof of my freedom, I would have none. My life has been wasted. I would at least give value to my death. Ramon frowned. My people own slaves without my opposition. I cannot say I'm opposed to slavery on principle, yet I find your situation intolerable. Why? I do not know, and it is that which draws me to you, the desire to understand why it should matter to me now. My death, you mean? Yes. Perhaps because I see in mine what you cannot see in yours, the opportunity to become something greater than I was when alive. What know you of my life? That it is not like mine, or that of any other living man in this colony. I know you, vampire, know your kind from childhood stories. How else could you walk in and out of this place without question, the way you do, bending minds to your will? Unlike you, I have no delusions about my station in life or what I can hope to achieve in this society. All I have left to offer is a better future to those who come. Martyrdom? That implies individual acclaim. I am no one, have not been allowed to be. My death, if remembered at all, will be as part of a whole, a single event. He faltered, his throat parched. Ramon left the room, returned with fresh water, which the man drank gratefully. We are not important as men, he continued finally, spoke hesitantly but deliberately, but as an idea that this life we live is wrong, that we must all resist. Each rebellion plants the seeds of the next, each bigger. The force used it to quash it more brutal over and over until the taste for killing sours in their mouths, until even their own people see the injustice, and together we end it. Rahman used his power over mortal minds to ease the man's pain. Revived, they talked more about how he came to be where he was and how Rahman arrived at his path until his companion was too weak to continue for long. Rahman touched his shoulder. I could cure these wounds, grant you life eternal to continue your struggle. But say the word. A ragged smile spread across the man's face. Do you not see? If I was as you are, it would no longer be my struggle, as this is not yours. You see me as imprisoned, while you are far more bound by illusion. Illusion? The man spoke slowly, as if each word counted out his remaining minutes. You delude yourself. You are still the son of your father and grandson of his. The man you were born died centuries ago. You are now a god, or a demigod at the very least. Do not lie to yourself by saying you intervened because you cared about my fate. It only pleased you to exercise your power, reminded of it. You are a vampire who thought he was a man, trying to be a vampire again. I admit I do not know who or what I am. That is for you to decide. I only know who I am. That has taken me what lifetime I've had, but let me be the man I am and do what he must do. Yes, Rahman could see that this night had come to an end for them both. I have learned all I needed to know. He paused as he turned to depart before the sun. You never told me your name. How am I to remember you? The man moaned, breath ragged and hollow. By my deeds, my death. They leave a mark my name never could. Remember me by them. I can swear that much at least. Then I die avenged. Rahman smiled at that, saw again the power of his will to shape the world, and thought he might have one last deed to perform here. Not entirely, not quite. He faded into the darkness. Rahman's third visit, promised visit, was at the man's graveside. His death had taken place that very day, so Rahman, unable to attend, had hurtling reports from Finn. The man was burned alive and inhaled the smoke deeply as it rose, so it would overtake him before the flames, as Rahman had advised him. The town celebrated. The rebellion was finally over. Already, draconian improvements to the laws restricting slaves were being proposed. Only time would tell what the rebels had done for their people. Rahman was the only one at the funeral who might live long enough to find out. There was something moving about burial at night. The shadows lent added sobriety to the ceremony. It had been outlawed without the express permission of slave owners for slaves to gather in numbers of more than three or to travel at night without a lamp. But Rahman had quietly made sure with persuasive visits to each master that all who wished to attend this gathering were able to do so without penalty. The pallbearers complained as they lowered the coffin deep into the ground how heavy he had felt for such a small man when carried so far into the wild wood. The funeral was short. Prayers were said, songs were sung, they covered him well, and all slipped back to where they belonged as Rahman returned to the work to prepare for his departure. Tillinghast was there on deck as he supervised the loading of the last of Rahman's crates by moonlight. The vampire smiled broadly. Sir, you have been busy tonight, I hear. Nothing that might upset your cart, I hope. Not at all. I like seeing the good citizens of New York shaken out of complacency from time to time. In the end, all is as it should be. The rebellion is ended. Laws will change for the worse, I fear. But the people feel safer with their administrator's ability to protect them. I have my payment, and you have your cargo. God's in his heaven, all's right with the world. Rahman said nothing. The last of the crates went aboard, and Tillinghast signaled for his men to depart. He turned to Rahman before he left the ship. One bit of odd news. It seems the owner of the leader of the rebellion has gone missing. Indeed. Yes, went out to celebrate his errant slave's execution tonight, but never made it home. There is some local speculation he may have been waylaid by some renegade slaves with a grudge and come to grievous harms at their hands. Oh, I'm quite sure he is alive, said Rahman, wherever he is. More likely he has seen the error of his ways and gone in seclusion to do penance. Then you think he will return? Rahman shook his head gravely. I'm in doubt. He had many sins to consider and will need some considerable length of time to do so thoroughly. In seclusion? where better to meditate on one's character than by oneself, or perhaps with a single soul to provide company or forgiveness is so inclined. A sort of spiritual guide, one might say. A spirit, yes, very much so. Tillinghast nodded and started away. He turned back, a sly smile on his lips. One last peculiarity that may amuse you. My negroes told me they heard that the coffin buried tonight, that of his rebellious slave, seemed particularly large and heavy on the way to its final rest. Oddly so, considering his size and the circumstances of his passing. Said he weighed near as much as two men. People say many such things in these sad moments. Burdens and grief often seem heavier than they are. All that was buried here was what needed to be. Any other talk is idle gossip. I did not think you indulged in such things, Tillinghast. Ramon looked him directly in the eyes and saw only amusement there, no betrayal or concern. I agree. All that need be buried was indeed. The deceased slaves was not the only lost life put to rest tonight, eh? He chuckled and sauntered down the gangplank with a grace that belied his size. Delighted that you are finally free as well, Ramon. Enjoy your liberty from the living for as long as you wish, with no rebuke from me. Tillinghast climbed into his carriage and departed, followed by his slaves of all variety. Ramon watched him go until out of sight, the signal his crew to cast off before the dawn to head north. The 1,000-year-old vampire Ramon al-Hazrad ibn Aziz stood on the deck of a stolen ship, piloted by the slaves of his supernatural will, and sailed to whatever future his fate held, knowing it to finally be honestly his own to change. Where that took him, only time would tell, but Tillinghast had been right. He had buried all he needed to here. The end.
For a minute, and the birth of jazz you'll hear. And where there is a little jazz, you always find me near. For I'm a jazz vampire. Shake a foot, shake a foot, shake a foot with me and dance, dance. Dancing is my specialty. Wise men keep bottom away. They know I lead them astray. They fall the minute I sway. I insist you can't resist a jazz.
And you can't resist Burial by Terrence Taylor, read for you by the author here over WBAI, New York.
Went down to the river, stood on the bank, shook my shoulders and the boats all sang. For I'm the kind of jazz vampire, of the wicked vampire of the jazz. Get up in the morning and I make the coffee roll. Ham and egg turnover, put the crullers in a hole. Get upon a trolley car, the car begins to sway. Sit upon a half a dozen lamps to start the day. I walk into the office and I greet the starter there. Six or seven elevators go up in the air. Sit down at my Remington and syncopate the keys. The fellow by the water stand gets water on the knees. The boss dictates a letter. Dear sir, I'd like to say, the man who gets the letter has to stop and hesitate. And when the day is over and the sunset's in the west, say I'm the only little bird who doesn't go to rest. For I'm a jazz vampire. Take a tip, take a tip, take a tip from me, for I am all the evil music has. I stood by the ocean, no one around. Shook my shoulders and the sun went down. For I'm the meanest kind of jazz vampire. I'm the wicked vampire of the jazz.
Harris, the classic Marion Harris, 1920, actually, recording of Jazz Vampire.
It's only 200 years off. It's
something like that.
Could have been going through Roman's head. But,
95, yeah, well.
I actually enjoyed rereading that. I hadn't read it in quite some time.
That's a good story.
Thank you.
So how would it be different?
Well, it's a simple thing. The issue they had, we have enough time, I can tell you, without killing it the rest of the time for you to do announcements. But the one issue they had was that they felt that by the end, Roman had changed enough. Yes, Rose and Daniel. And I agreed with them. Their issue was that Roman didn't get sufficient change, that the main character wasn't in sufficiently different a space.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, okay, you're right. But the fix is actually very simple, because the crux of the matter is the course of the story is him understanding two things. One, the essential nature of who one is and what one does, regardless of outside influence, and applying it to a greater good. But the other thing is the nature of his relationship with his victims, that he is a slaver, like it or not.
Right.
And I said, what I want to do is at the end, where he's on the dock and he's having the conversation with Tillinghast, and he's getting the ship, getting his supplies, he frees his crew. He tells the captain of the ship, I will take my supplies, I will take horseback, I will proceed into upstate New York, is where he's headed, on my own. You are now your own men again. You may be free. And, of course, the guy's looking at him like, I don't understand what you're saying to me. You're my master, and you own me, and I don't... It's like, no, I'm freeing you. And he commands him to live his own life and live it well, and as he does the rest of the crew, and sends them off, and he frees the crew.
Yeah.
And that's the change for him.
That would be the transcendent.
That is the seriously different space for Roman to
occupy.
The
redemption, yeah.
Yes, and the thing is that in the first novel, Roman...
I'm thinking of that, but is that in his character, really? I mean, I can see where they would like that as an arc.
Yes. Well, it is because of a very essential thing of something he does 200 years later. In the first novel, we get a detail
of the Vampire Testament
entitled Bite Marks. The first issue. The first novel, when we meet Roman, the first time we meet him is in the time of the crash of the Hindenburg. Some renegade vampires from Europe are planning to come to New York, take it over, victimize the leaders of the city, and just begin a revolution under the carpet that no one knows about. And he and other vampires stop it, not to give away too much. It's only the first 20 pages of the novel. But as a result of that incident, the vampires of New York formed the Society of the Veil, an organization of vampires solely devoted to two things: the concealment of vampire existence, and the concealment of vampire existence is by not going overboard. You don't wipe out a community. You don't do things that are overt. But it's also had to do with his sense of order and reason. And that gets shaped by this incident. After this, he's more inclined to look for a way to discipline his own kind. He understands the essential nature of vampires. He understands they need to be disciplined. Otherwise, they're just going to reveal everything, but also destroy natural humanity.
Yeah.
So this is for me.
And it is sort of too bad that he doesn't survive the first book.
Well, yeah, and you know, technically, I could probably figure a way to bring him back. He's
no
an alchemist.
I mean,
you know, if I really worked at it, I could bring him back.
Nothing is forever.
Exactly. If you don't want it to be, I've been reading 400 issues of X-Men. No one dies. No one loses their powers. They all get them back 20 issues later. So, I mean, I could always find a way to restore Roman, but I actually prefer to let him end there. It's a bit of a spoiler. Sorry if people haven't read the book, but he did live over 1,000 years. I've got more than enough terrain to cover it. And this was an interesting exercise because it showed me how to dip into those past stories and to find those things that essentially create character. So for me, it was interesting because it was like young Sherlock Holmes in these movies where you meet characters in the earlier version of them and they do a thing that you go, oh, that's why he wears the deer so
before they
cap.
Were stars.
That's why he, this is, and for me, this story was the inciting moment of Roman's return to humanity on a moral level. Even if not scientifically, he's trying to become human again.
Right.
But this reminds him that that's an internal process. It's not necessarily chemistry and biology. He may never physically be human again, but he can be more humane. And he can not victimize people without callous thought, you know, with just doing it, which is what he had done. He just took over the ship. They're bad guys. Screw it. I'm biting them all. They're all mine. And it's like, oh, this is wrong. And It was also about the Socratic dialogue between him and the leader of the rebellion.
Yeah, which is what I liked. And,
yeah, and to me, that was the crux
of it. And the whole metaphor of the slave and the slavers.
And also to me, the thing was, in reading about this actual incident, we don't know who these people were. They did something impossible to accomplish, as many of the rebellions were. They were more symbolic than anything else. And it's like the slave ship where 100 guys just got up and just dived overboard. They'd rather drown than go to the Americas as slaves. And that was an interesting ability to sort of define the essence of self-sacrifice on that scale and why someone would allow themselves to be just completely wiped out in the interests of sending a message to Ripple hundreds of years ahead with no idea if it's ever going to be heard.
Right.
So that was very nice. I like that. That character was grew from just all the readings of the individual stories.
So are you going to send that out? What are you going to do?
I'm going to change the ending and send it out again. I'm going to submit it other places. I really like the story.
Yeah,
it's like,
no,
this has a life,
story.
And I'm going to change the ending, fix it, tweak it a little bit. It spots.
And by the way, good reading. Good reading.
Thank you. Thank you. I haven't read in a long time, and I thank you for the opportunity, because I haven't had a chance to just
read
someone
before,
to sleep.
But I liked your pace this time, if I may.
Yeah, no.
Non-criticize you on the air.
No, that's lovely.
Very often, a lot of people read too fast. A lot of writers read their own work too fast. And I liked the pace. I liked
It kept it going a nice clip, but I didn't feel like people were missing it. Thank you. I was like,
oh,
God.
You did the voice as well.
Yeah, it was like, okay, I got to distinguish. There's a lot of dialogue in this for me.
Yeah, but you also changed your attitude, physical attitude, towards the microphone.
Oh, yes, that's very funny.
So that one character's like this and another like this.
Oh, and it changes the thing. Wow, that was unconscious. I didn't even realize I was doing that.
Yeah, well, maybe not consciously, but you are an you're a producer.
I'm a media person. I record sound sessions.
And you're wearing
sessions.
Your headphones.
So I can hear. Exactly.
So I think that you knew without knowing.
Well, the thing is, for Roman, I was trying to do this lower sort of like flatter delivery, and I had to get closer to the mic for that.
Exactly.
And when I was doing the other character, he's much more out like this.
See, everybody at home, he's getting closer to the mic.
It's interesting. I unconsciously, I found the space to be able to create the distinction in space physically for them while talking to each other. Because that's the hardest thing, doing two voices and characters having a dialogue plausibly. But thank you. You've now sprung me. I now am also publicly obligated to finish the third novel because I promised everyone on air that I'm going to.
Yes, so. Exactly. And a promise made on Hour of the Wolf.
It must be,
must be how
it has to be.
And speaking of which, it is time for us. So thank you, Terrence Taylor,
for being here.
Bite marks and
blood pressure. You can go to terrencetaylor.com, TERENCE, and read more about them and see some more readings.
And you'll be back.
Yes, with Past Life. Readings from the third novel.
Stay tuned for Burn Baby Burn Clapper with Lister coming your way on these airwaves in just 2 minutes. This has been Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. Thank you so much for listening. Visit us on Facebook in the Hour of the Wolf group or at ourwolf.com, a very out-of-date website, but hey, it's there with all kinds of info. Take good care of yourselves. Take good care of each other. And enjoy your week. Good morning.
that I am a proletarian. I am a
trying to reach my freedom of speech and expressing myself, torching the symbol of oppression. Let that be a lesson to those that want suppression of the truth. Put on hold, the bold lose control, so they force obedience. Have you pledge allegiance to a piece of cloth? That's all the way I see it. Well, I'm going off berserk, cause the system works to jerk my people, the people all around the pigs work. Tell me I'm wrong, though, that's my right in this writing. The Constitution, yo, that's an illusion. Huh, suckers trying to change and rearrange. That I'm free, but they sure have a strange way of showing it. But I'm blowing the cover, the red, white, the blue, but the black for the brother. And I'm the lover of this flag, like many others take the same turn. Like me, they yearn for the flag too. A nightmare. I want the people to wake up to the lies, the pigs, makeup, imperialistic swines that I grind into bacon bits. Call it fist, cause I ain't taking shit. I'm not a Nazi or a Cappy or a Farmy, but you want me in prison, cause I'm busy attacking the flag. I rag it and snag it and drag it and rip it to shreds, cause I'm too black, too strong, too red, too dread. And I'm dreaded, cause I make the pigs tremble when I burn a symbol. Yo, I'm quick and nimble like Jack, but I'm a black man attacking the flag. I keep my torch handy. I'm no Yankee Doodle Dandy, so just hand me a flag from the fastest. And watch me burn that piece up to ashes. Cause the real meaning is what the message must be. That's why the red, white, and blue must burn, baby, burn.
The flag, I'm only doing what you told me. You don't like it, so what? I'm not scared of you. Your flag, America. minutes after 3 o'clock. You're in tune to Radio Station WBAI 99.5 FM, New York, y'all. This is a show that burns the imperialist red, white, and blue to ashes without any apology, y'all. I'm a rebel soul, y'all.
Rebel soul.
Burn, baby, burn.
I am rebel soul. I am rebel soul. Belong, I am rebel soul. 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 I give a light to brighten up my day. Thank you.